Hi, this is Bennett Kelly. Thanks for listening to CyberLaw and Business Report. Before you take a recess to hear the latest internet law news and commentary, you are hereby ordered to download the WebmasterRadio.fm mobile app for iPhone and Android. Okay, maybe not ordered, but why not? You can listen live to my show and all our show hosts every day on our live stream or download past episodes with ease. So download the WebmasterRadio.fm mobile app in the iTunes Store or in the Google Play Store. It's an open and shut case.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. Welcome to another Cyber Law and Business Report. This is Bennett Kelly talking to you live from Santa Monica, California, the Internet Law Center here in the heart of Silicon Beach. Our first guest today is Andrew Crocker, and Andrew is a legal fellow with the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Civil Liberties team, and he's previously worked with the Berkman Center for Internet Society, as well as the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Project and the Center for Democracy and Technology, a bunch of very well-respected organizations. Andrew, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to thank you for joining us. And we're, I think the biggest story this year in both not just the internet sphere, but even, you know, in terms of, you know, domestic story, has been the U.S. the NSA scandal that's been going on that was revealed through Andrew Snowden's leak. And and you guys...
That's right. Go ahead.
It seems that you guys have been very active on this issue, you know, going back even before this leak, in terms of some of the revelations that came out during the Bush administration, but especially after the leak, you've been very active and very vocal in terms and pushing to get access to documents. The NSA, it creates this strange syndrome where the NSA would justify its position on spying because there's these secret FISA courts, as they're known. But then, of course, we can't release the opinion that justifies it because that's classified. And that you guys have been instrumental in trying to lift some of the layers of the onion to reveal what's going on. And I guess to start off, maybe the best part is the one thing that's been frustrating about the NSA scandals, each week it seems to be bigger. You know, there's a new story, there's a new avenue that we weren't aware of was being looked at before. And so if you had synopsize what is the scope of the NSA scandal today, what would be the best way to say that?
Well, it's a good question. It does seem to keep growing as we turn around each time. There's a new story, sort of a new angle on it. And I think you're right in going back to even before the releases from this year. There were a series of stories in 2005 and 2006 calling attention to warrantless wiretapping of internet content and metadata, as well as collection of phone records. And EFF, as you said, has been trying to call attention to that since early in that period. We had a lawsuit against the telecommunications carriers called Hepting, subsequently brought suit against the NSA for the collection of internet content and metadata based on some whistleblower testimony from AT&T technicians inside a facility here in San Francisco who had personally witnessed splitting of fiber optic cables and copying within a secret room in the AT&T facility. So that all happened long before these news stories came out in June earlier this year. We've sort of seen some confirmation of those particular programs early on in the Snowden revelations. There were confirmations of the government's sort of ongoing collection of telephone records and confirmation both of sort of bulk collection of internet metadata and content through this upstream fiber optic splitter, and also collection from internet companies through the PRISM program, as it's called. And that was in what we learned sort of early in June. And since then, there's been a number of revelations on kind of a number of different fronts, some of the more, sort of more attention-getting ones have been related to our diplomatic relations with other countries, spying on foreign leaders. Yet a sort of separate strand of this is the NSA's efforts to undermine cryptography and other security measures in popularly used software and services as a way of getting access to contents of communications. And then I think sort of one relatively more recent revelation that has gotten a lot of attention is the story that was published in the Washington Post last month revealing that the NSA has access to the private fiber optic links between data centers from companies like Google and Yahoo, and that those links were, at least at the point of the story, unencrypted, and that the NSA was getting access to vast amounts of data traveling between the private data centers of these companies.
And did they have knowledge of that?
Did the companies have knowledge of that?
Yes.
They have denied knowledge of that. I think we saw very quickly after the story, the CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, was very, very angry about it. Public postings on specific Google engineers' pages, using profanity, being very upset about it. All appearances show that they were not aware of it. Google, very early, right before this story was published, Google had announced that it was going to be encrypting the data links between the links between its data centers. And just a few days ago, Yahoo announced that they soon will be doing the same thing. So they are certainly outwardly reacting to this, both by taking specific measures and with outrage.
Now, a couple of things come to mind, and as this has the way it's unfolded, and the breadth of which it's unfolded, it's scandal management 101 is that you want to get behind this behind you. You have to disclose everything. You know, for example, the thing that caused the Clinton administration so much pain, grievance was the whole Whitewater investigation, and part of the whole thing that blew up on them was they held back information, and then that led to Paula Jones, which led to the impeachment and all this other stuff, and so it doesn't seem like that lesson's been learned here. And the other thing is that a lot of our current legal structure comes from a prior era in the 70s when they were investigating abuses that had happened then through what was known as the Church Commission after Frank Church, the chairman of the committee, the special committee. And that there's no effort to do a Church Commission here. And I don't know if it's just because no one wants to touch it or if the Republicans feel that there's no political gain to be made because it would also involve disclosing abuses by President Bush, or the Democrats are just trying to thwart an investigation because they don't want to embarrass President Obama. I mean, it seems like that would be the best – another Church Commission would be the best way to go, because let's get this out in the open and to decide what we want to have.
I think EFF would agree with you on that. We've certainly called for something akin to a Church Commission. And you're right that none of the current legislative suggestions for addressing the scandal do go quite that far. Some of the bills that are out there right now do take some good steps in terms of transparency, requiring the significant decisions of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the secret court that you're mentioning, be released. That there'd be reporting and oversight from the Inspector General, that the Civil Liberties Oversight Board would have power to subpoena and piecemeal get some of the things that a church committee might be able to get. But you're right, there hasn't quite gone that far yet. I think we're still sort of waiting to see how this will all shake out in terms of reforms that will come out of it. It's not clear exactly where this is going.
Now, President Obama has appointed some commissions to look into this, and DFS is critical of those commissions, saying that they can't achieve their objective. Why is that?
At least in part, I think in the past we've sort of felt that it's a half-hearted effort to help them achieve their goal, that they were unstaffed, that the Civil Liberties Oversight Board that I mentioned was unstaffed for quite a while, and when it comes to releasing opinions, as I was mentioning, they, have been somewhat withholding of those opinions. In the last several months, we've seen significant opinions of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISC, be released, but they're redacted in such a way that we don't really know what the underlying legal opinions are. And so these sort of efforts of the executive branch don't go far enough. And for that reason, I think we feel like it's not a fully good faith effort.
And what do you attribute that to? Is it just that, is there some philosophical difference, or is there just such, are they just wedded to this regime? Or why is it that, for example, the current administration can't provide more transparency?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. There are obviously very serious national security concerns at play here, and EFF and no one else would sort of dispute that there is very sensitive information here that can't be released. I think that that doesn't stand in the way of sort of transparency and the public's right to know about these sort of vast surveillance programs that are going on. I can't sort of speak to why that is so hard to do. I'm sure that there's a sort of a lot of answers out there for why that would be.
Right, and to subscribe a psychology to a government of how many thousand people.
Very, very hard to do, of course.
That's a big couch. So, I mean, it is odd, though. I mean, you have a president who's a constitutional law professor, and you have this setup that raises serious constitutional questions, especially when that involving the Fourth Amendment. Now tell us a little bit about your current lawsuit, the first Unitarian lawsuit.
So as I mentioned before, we have a standing lawsuit against the NSA relating to the evidence about the fiber optic splitter in the facility here in San Francisco. That's called Jeweled, and that's a class action on behalf of all AT&T customers whose content.
And where is that?
Sorry?
Where does that stand right now?
So we are, we had a case management conference in that case earlier this fall, and the current state of that is there's a briefing due in which the government has to go back and look at all of the declarations it's submitted in secret, and in light of the most recent disclosures that we were talking about, see if there's anything that it can now release publicly. So we're expecting that on December 20th, and we'll be moving forward from there. It's had a complex procedural history. It went up on appeal on the issue of standing to the Ninth Circuit and is now back in the district court, the Northern District of California. The other big case that we have was filed after the disclosures, and it specifically challenges the call records program that we were talking about earlier. In that case, First Unitarian Church of Los Angeles versus NSA, we represent 22 advocacy organizations that named plaintiff, the First Unitarian Church, Human Rights Watch, Greenpeace, Cal Guns Foundation, a Second Amendment group, the National Lawyers Guild, a whole range of advocacy organizations who allege that their First Amendment freedom association is impinged by this call records collection program.
How so?
And in that case, we have actually just moved for summary judgment. About 2 weeks ago, we filed a motion for partial summary judgment on the statutory claim that this call records program is not authorized by the law that the government says it is authorized by, and that it violates the First Amendment. And just this week, we've had several amicus briefs filed in that case, including a brief filed by the ACLU on behalf of Wyden, Udall, and Heinrich, arguing that they have seen no evidence that this mass collection of phone records is an effective means of fighting terrorism. And, we think that's some pretty powerful testimony from senators who are tasked with the oversight of the NSA.
Right, and they are on the Intelligence Committee. And it's interesting because Wyden has been saying for some time, I can't say how bad it is, but it's bad.
Exactly.
And which is troubling. And now we're talking about, obviously everything's in a lot of analogies, but the NSA in essence is saying, we need to take the haystack to find the needle. Mm-hmm. And so that justifies us sucking in as much information as out there. But we're very careful once we have it. And I guess what Wyden is saying is there's no justification for that.
That's right. They've said that they you know, they point in their amicus brief, which they filed specifically, to other means of acquiring the same information in a targeted way that doesn't infringe on innocent average Americans' privacy in the same way. And so their point is that there's really no need for this bulk mass collection of telephone records. As you said, they've been trying to call attention to this for some time, and it's really only after these disclosures that it's come to the public's attention in the way that I think they were hoping it would.
Now, you know, obviously things in Washington right now aren't operating at optimal levels, but I don't really see an appetite to really take on NSA reform at this time. I mean, do you foresee anything happening either this year or even this Congress?
Well, as you say, it's very hard to forecast, and obviously things aren't optimal. I think that here at EFF we are optimistic that there's some reforms to be done and that it's not impossible. EFF was part of a big coalition that organized a rally in Washington at the end of last month, the Stop Watching Us rally, and thousands and thousands of people showed up to that rally, and their elected officials have been hearing about it. So, you know, and as we said earlier, as you alluded to earlier, there are several bills introduced in the current Congress that take different approaches to doing NSA reform, and so I think it's not impossible, no.
Now, for reform to be meaningful, what are some of the what are the touchstones that you feel are essential to any reform proposal?
Well, so we've been doing a lot of work on sort of analyzing, comparing the various bills that have come out, and it's as I'm sure you know, is a very sort of involves a lot of nitty gritty of amending statutory language. I think on a high level view, we're looking at transparency. So the sort of thing that we were talking about earlier, reporting of decisions. Then we also talk about advocacy. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISC, is an ex parte court where the government represented side, but there isn't the other side is ever represented. And the parties affected by it, the providers who are ordered to give over phone records, for instance, don't or haven't to this point challenged the orders that come out. So we're looking for some sort of adversarial representation. And of course, just stopping mass surveillance, period, of phone records and other types of mass surveillance. Different bills have approached that in different ways. We have a post up that I would urge people to read about the Leahy Sensenbrenner bill, which analyzes it in more depth than we want to go into right here, and talks about the good and the bad of it. And we call it a floor, not a ceiling, to reform certain things that we haven't seen in these bills that we'd like to see are discussion of what to do about the undermining of cryptography standards that I mentioned.
That's huge.
Yes, it is. It is huge. And as far as I know, that hasn't really been addressed in any of the proposals so far. We haven't had a church commission called for, as you mentioned. These don't address the state secrets privilege. They don't address the authority under which the government collects information outside of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is the Executive Order 12333, and that's actually the authority that we think that they're using to spy on those data center links that we were talking about earlier. So there's a lot to be done, and no bill is perfect. So that's the sort of EFF wish list, I guess.
And on the cryptology thing, I mean the stupid aspect of it is, someone's going to figure it out, and so now that we all know that these back doors, for the NSA. Everyone's going to be looking for it, and they're going to be exploited. And so, in essence, the NSA is set up a regime that makes everyone less safe.
Yeah, that's the case that you've heard some very prominent people making recently. Bruce Schneier, a prominent internet security expert, who's also, I should say, on the EFF board, has made that very case very very strongly and convincingly. I think that this isn't the way to get better security. By undermining security that we all use day to day, isn't the way to be secure or be safe. On a sort of related issue, there was a secure email provider called Lavabit that shut down after being asked to turn over its encryption keys. In a redacted case, but which many have speculated is related to these leaks and. Compelling internet providers to give over their encryption keys is another thing that makes everyone less safe and undermines the sort of basic security of the internet. And so that's the sort of thing that Schneier and others have talked about as you know, an odd and unwise way of getting at safety and security.
And it's, you know, I don't, you know, obviously we're very much focused on the internet on the show, and it's caused a lot of people to suspect doing business with U.S. internet companies. And, you know, the U.S. has been fortunate in that the internet it gave birth to it here and has had a large amount of control over the internet through, you know, its close relationship with ICANN. And as ICANN has its, you know, latest meeting out in Buenos Aires, you know, one of the big open questions is to what extent should the U.S. role still be that? And so it's really set us back in a number of ways. But the one question, you know, we're going to take a short break. But when we come back, I just want to ask you a couple of quick questions, and then we'll find out more about how people can learn more about the EFF after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Oh, yeah. My day is done. Time for happy hour.
You're already done for the day?
Yeah, because I use CertifiedKnowledge.org. Their PPC tools literally save me hours every day.
How do you keep on top of all of Google's new features?
Easy. With Certified Knowledge, their interactive learning modules keep me up to date. And if there's something I don't know, I can watch their video lessons without having to hunt around the Google help files.
Great. I'm ready to expand my knowledge.
Hi, I'm Brett Geddes. I'm the only leader officially supported by Google to teach the advanced track of the AdWords Seminars for Success. I personally recommend CertifiedKnowledge.org as your one-stop shop for all your PPC needs.
Learn, optimize, connect. Be smart. Go to CertifiedKnowledge.org now.
Why do over 15,000 small businesses love working with Infusionsoft?
Because we believe in people and their dreams.
We empower entrepreneurs, and our groundbreaking tools help small businesses grow and thrive.
We listen. We care.
We serve our customers, and we do what we say we'll do. We're always trying to find new ways to innovate and to improve our all-in-one sales and marketing platform. Most of all, from email to e-commerce,
we help small businesses like yours succeed.
Go to infusionsoft.com/radio to watch a free product demo. That's infusionsoft.com/radio.
Ever wondered how you could have access to your own SEO expert, paid search specialist, or social media wizard? Looking for help with your affiliate, display media, or email marketing? Look no further than the folks at Fang Digital Marketing. Fang Digital specializes in both paid and organic search, social media, display, and mobile advertising solutions, and is staffed by industry veterans from Google, Yahoo, and one of the industry's most influential PPC experts. Fang Digital's award-winning staff stays on top of the latest in digital.
Webmasterradio.fm. We're everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking about the NSA with Andrew from the EFF. And who has time on their side? I mean, the NSA is such a complex issue, and it will the length of time going by, will it make it harder? You know, is it pro-reform people or the anti-reform people who benefit the longer this issue doesn't really get addressed?
That's a good, you know, it's a complex question. I think, you know, maybe sort of part of the premise of your question is that the status quo benefits the longer it's not addressed, and there's probably some truth to that. You know, that surveillance continues until there's an injunction in our case, for instance.
I'm wondering if passions will wane, since it's such a complex issue and it's hard to get people's attention focused on something for long, that, you know, the people may move on.
I think there is that risk. I also think that to some extent the cat is out of the bag. We've learned so much about this in the last 6 months, and to some extent it goes a lot further than anyone would have anticipated. And you know, we've seen, it's not just the EFF, the ACLU, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, has been trying to call attention to this with litigation. There's other pending litigation and reform efforts and grassroots activism and a lot of action on the international stage as well. I don't think that those things are going to go away. And, you know, you're right to maybe wonder if some of the flame can die down a little bit, but I don't think that these are revelations that just, you know, that just people lose track of. These are sort of basic rights at stake. And so, I don't think it's going to go away. Whether time helps that move forward, we'll have to see.
Now, Andrew, we only have a few minutes left, so if people want to learn more about this area, where should they go?
So our website has a very good and growing compendium of sources on both on NSA spying issue and of course other related issues. Just if they go to EFF.org and click on NSA spying, there's a sort of large compendium, how it works, the frequently asked questions, recently added primary sources page, a timeline of all the events that we've been talking about. There's really a lot there and a lot more detail than we obviously could go into in this.
And Andrew's not kidding. It is a great resource, a great page. Now, I noticed your bio says your interests include methods of brewing, boggle, and then donuts.
Yeah.
Can you explain about donuts?
Well, I think it's somewhat self-evident that donuts are just a delicious treat and that... You know, I've yet to meet anyone who doesn't like donuts. I've met people who say that they can't eat them because they're not healthy, but I haven't yet to meet anyone who doesn't like donuts.
Now, it links to Dynamo Donut. Is that your shop or?
Oh no, that's a local San Francisco chain. They have I think several locations, and you can certainly get them in coffee shops around here. I didn't actually put that link in. Someone who put the bio online put it in for me, and I said, those are delicious.
And the website has this wonderful tagline at the bottom, give donut love from your mobile via kudos.co or TC, whatever. And definitely.
They are delicious donuts, I will say.
All right. So we didn't think we'd cover donut love in our discussion of the NSA, but we did cover a lot. And Andrew, I want to thank you again. And always thanks to EFF for all the help they've given us over the years. So thank you again. And everyone, Andrew Crocker from EFF.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
And our next guest is courtesy of the Miami Book Fair International. I want to thank them again for giving us Michael Grunwald. He's the author of The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Administration, and just gives remarkable insight into the what was known as the stimulus package or the Obama Recovery Act. And Michael is a former Time senior correspondent, and he's won the George Polk Award for National Reporting. And he will be at the Miami Book Fair on November 23rd. So if you're in Miami, you get to check him out. But we're really thrilled to have him. This book has been praised as one of the most thoughtful political books of the year.
Your new book is The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. And what led you to focus on that part of the Obama administration?
Sure. Well, the book is about the stimulus bill that President Obama signed into law less than a month after he took office. And, you know, the idea of the book is that not only did this bill help prevent a depression, turned around one of the worst economic freefalls in American history, but that it also was sort of a mechanism for the change we can believe in that we had heard so much about during the campaign. That not only was this a short-term economic boost, but that this really was the long-term Obama agenda, whether you like it or not, to sort of transform energy, education, the beginning of healthcare reform, and not just to provide an economic boost, but to change the way the economy is structured with, you know, the largest infrastructure investments since Eisenhower and the largest research investments ever, some of the largest transportation initiatives that we've seen in decades. I was just going to say that the book really, you know, as I started reporting on the stimulus, I realized that this was really was the way to tell the story of change in the Obama era, that if you understood what happened with the stimulus in that first month, that nothing during the rest of his administration should really come as that big a surprise.
What's interesting is that it seems like the Obama, and I think you addressed this, is that the Obama administration has run away from the stimulus. He wasn't the key part of his campaign in for re-election, and you don't see Democrats really bragging about the stimulus.
No, it's true. It's sort of fallen to me on Twitter. I'm the only one pointing out that every time, certainly Obama and his administration has been more than willing to hype the good things that have come out of the stimulus, particularly sure. The doubling of renewable energy, race to the top in education. We've already quadrupled the percentage of doctors and hospitals that use health information technology, electronic medical records. And they'll certainly talk about that, about the Pell Grants, about the unemployment benefits, about the middle class tax cuts, all kinds of good stuff. They just didn't like talking about the word stimulus because people hated the stimulus. They kind of liked the stuff that was in it, but it became this symbol of everything that they didn't like about the way 2009 was going. Because remember, it was sort of a jobs bill that passed at a time when jobs were hemorrhaging, and it did a really good job of stopping that hemorrhaging, right? We were losing 800,000 jobs a month when Obama took office. By a few months after the stimulus passed, the recession ended, and by 2010, we were starting to add jobs again. But all people saw was that unemployment was up to double digits, and they weren't happy, and stimulus really became a kind of dirty word.
Now, we've focused on the stimulus a little bit on this show. We've actually had people from Chattanooga on, because what Chattanooga did with the help of a stimulus grant was to create a smart grid and for their electric utility, and in process of doing so, they laid down broadband, which gave them download and upload speeds of a gigabyte per second, and it made them the fastest internet city in the country. And overnight, you have VCs from Silicon Valley flying to Chattanooga, which I could do some research on this, but I'm pretty confident it wasn't happening before.
Well, as I always say, thanks, stimulus. There are stories like that all over the country. I wrote about the smart grid in the book. I tell a story about in my backyard, where in Miami, where there's a $200 million investment that was going on to put in smart meters, but also some of the more this infrastructure stuff where you're automating substations and you're all kinds of high-tech stuff that nobody ever sees. The example I used was I went to talk to the guy who's in charge of the project, and he told me about the 2011 Orange Bowl. During the game at the stadium here, the smart grid, which was monitoring these transformers every 30 times a second, something they used to actually have to send a dude to go check out the transformer once a year. Now they're monitored constantly, and they found something started blinking red, and the transformer was going to go on the fritz. Well, they just saw that it was happening, and the grid automatically routed electricity from another transformer, and so the light stayed on. Otherwise, they could have blacked out the Orange Bowl. Now, of course, nobody knew that the Orange Bowl didn't black out and could have blacked out. At the time, that was seen as an absurd thing. I wrote the book before before it happened at the Super Bowl. but it's a perfect example of, here's a service that's provided by all this money that's preventing something that would have been a real problem, but nobody's ever going to know about it. So that's,
right.
If you had to take the bigger message of change is that, there's been a lot of change. It's made a really big difference, but people don't always feel the change, even though it's affecting their lives.
Well, here's a real irony. I just got out of curiosity. I looked up to see who was in the Orange Bowl, and Stanford won 40-12, but Jim Harbaugh was the coach.
well, I could have said he could have gotten them used to that.
Yeah, you had a real complex after that. Some people are electric, and some people are counter-electric, I guess. But any event, so the speaking of turning out the lights, there's the Republicans, and Obama comes in with this agenda, and they decide that they're going to stop it at all costs. And how different was this from their approach in 93 to the Clinton budget, which got zero votes, Republican votes? Was it really that different in any way?
Well, I guess not that different. Well, the big difference, certainly the zero Republican votes was quite similar. What I would say is that it was a different moment, right? The Clinton budget was a sort of a vote on the Clinton economic agenda. And true. Republicans had, they opposed that economic agenda, understandably. The stimulus was a pretty different situation, right? Because this was at a time really the worst economic emergency we'd had in 80 years. Democrats had just helped a Republican president pass a bailout for Wall Street. And now here comes this new president who had just been elected in this, it's still right, millions of people, yes we can, on the mall at Grant Park. And I describe in the book, I have talked to Republicans, and they sort of bragged to me about how even before Obama took office, they decided that they were going to oppose not just his economic agenda, but everything he did, anything major. Seven different Republican senators told that to Vice President Biden. They said, we're not going to be able to help you out. I quoted George Voinovich saying, if Obama was for it, we had to be against it. And you had the stimulus bill, which was in many ways stuff that the Republicans always claimed they'd been for and had been for in the past,
yes.
Things like unemployment benefits. They demanded $300 billion in tax cuts. There were $300 billion in tax cuts. Things like the smart grid, wind power, solar power, those had not been partisan issues before. Health information technology was a big Newt Gingrich priority. They only became Sharia socialism on January 20th, 2009, as this real, there was a real cynical, politically opportunistic decision by these Republicans in these meetings, these secret meetings that I describe, one led by Eric Cantor on the House side, the other led by Mitch McConnell on the Senate side, where they realized that, look, people in the country, they don't follow the details of everything, that happens in Washington. They just see, are they getting stuff done? Are they getting together and doing reasonable things? Or is it the same old partisan fighting? And they realized that by saying no, they could make things look like the same old partisan fighting. They could turn Obama into a promise breaker. And they've done that very consistently for 5 years.
And it's interesting because, I was actually doing a radio show with a conservative, inside Washington conservative, and I kept hearing the mantra, government does not create jobs. Government doesn't create jobs. And it was ironic because if you went to the Republican National Committee website at the time, they had a list of Republican achievements. And the first one was the funding, government funding and loan guarantees that enabled building of the Transcontinental Railway.
Right. Remember the loan guarantee that produced Solyndra was a program originally signed by President Bush and was completely uncontroversial again until January 2009. It was a very specific political strategy, and you've got to give them some credit because at the time people said, they'd pay a price for fighting a jobs bill during a jobs emergency. It took some guts to stand up and say no, right? It's the first black president. How dare they're not going to be able to stand up to him. But they did, and it, certainly in 2010, it worked.
Rewarded. Yeah.
And that's as their they've become, the country is getting, less demographically Republican, less ideologically Republican in many ways, as you see what's happening with gay marriage and immigration, and even, it's a less evangelical country. It's even a less older country, essentially, as a less rural country. You can see how Republicans have, they can try to assimilate or they can double down. But for the guys who are in Congress, right, most of them, what they've learned from these elections is, hey, I just got reelected. I'm in Congress. It's working, whatever I'm doing, as they play more to their base. Because most of the people in the middle have been alienated from the Republican Party. So the base elects more conservative candidates to go to Washington, and the base gets more conservative, the candidates get more conservative, and it's a kind of feedback loop. Once they've said enough, you know, once they've talked enough about this Kenyan socialist who is, you know, destroying the country, it makes it very difficult for them to then turn around and say, oh, and we've just done this really excellent compromise deal with the president. They're really under pressure to avoid primary challenges by maximizing their opposition at all times.
Now you referenced one person said, we're going to do what you did to us in 2006.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Building better search engine rankings takes the right formula. Tracking those rankings is super simple.
All you need is AuthorityLabs.com.
Authority Labs uses automated daily rank tracking tools to monitor your site's performance or leverage their API to build your own tools. No matter what animal-labeled algorithms affect your ranking,
you should be using Authority Labs.
Unlimited users for no additional cost and white labeling can help keep your clients updated and save countless hours of creating reports. Whether you're running sites with just a few or millions of keywords,
what you need is AuthorityLabs.com.
There are many things we would love to catch. Catching the final out of a baseball game.
And that's the ball game.
Reeling that big catch of the day. Or catching a ride home.
Taxi!
How about catching more attention, like the biggest retail brands on earth? Introducing Catchy.com, where they sell short branded attractive.com domain names. Use a short and catchy brand, just like Sony, Visa, and Nike for your next business venture. You can even rent to own for as low as $100 a month. Catch a big break for your business with Catchy.com.
Guys, are you suffering from FD, fulfillment dysfunction? Let MoldingBox.com's online portal system for inventory, tracking, and returns perform for you. We have the enormous tools you need for complete warehousing, shipping, and handling of all your packages, no matter the size or shape, directly to your customers. MoldingBox.com can also fulfill all your nourishing, nutraceutical, and smooth skincare product desires, including green coffee and Garcinia, on demand. Plus, let our in-house printing and CD-DVD manufacturing help you enlarge and maximize your coaching and business opportunity potential. We do everything. Fulfillment, shipping, tracking, inside and out, and all in one place. MoldingBox.com. It's shipping made sexy.
WebmasterRadio.fm. We're everywhere.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
I recall that era, but I don't necessarily recall, you know, a brick wall in Congress when it came to, you know, being receptive to what was coming from Pennsylvania Avenue.
No, and in fact, I tell a nice story in the book about how in January 2008, when the economy was starting to show some signs of real damage, there was President Bush proposed a stimulus package, $165 billion, which at the time was seen as really pretty big. And Hank Paulson, his Treasury Secretary, sat down with Nancy Pelosi, who was then the Speaker of the House, and John Boehner, who was then the House Minority Leader. And within a couple days, they had worked out a deal. And they overwhelmingly passed the Bush stimulus with bipartisan support. So again, stimulus did not become a dirty word until quite recently. And in fact, in January of 2009, House Republicans, including Paul Ryan, voted for a $700 billion stimulus that was almost identical to President Obama's $800 billion stimulus. So again, this was a conscious political choice that Republicans made. Now, some people can say that this was that it was a good choice, that they don't like the direction of the country under Obama, that he needs to be fought at every step of the way, and that's a legitimate stance, but that was their choice. Those are the facts.
Do you think, I mean, you often hear the phrase country first. Do you think they put the country first?
Well, I think they would argue that by making life as difficult as possible for Obama, that would, you know, help the country. You know, Mitch McConnell famously said that his top priority was to make Obama a one-term president. And so, you know, he was going to do whatever he could to achieve that goal. And there are a lot of stories, but I tried to tell while all this political fighting was going on, there was actual substantive stuff happening, behind the scenes. That's where you see this 1,200% increase in solar power, and this more than doubling of wind power at a time when we've now reached the levels that when Obama took office, the Energy Information Administration predicted that we would have this much wind power by 2040. So things have just taken off at this incredibly quick rate. Sorry, go ahead.
Now, one of the things also was the largest middle-class tax cut ever.
Right.
Republicans voted against the largest tax cut in history.
Right. Well, they calculated that they wouldn't pay a political price for that. And I think it's fair to say they didn't, except insofar as by taking this consistently, by becoming this party of no, and instead of, you can imagine a sort of alternative history where Republicans said, you know what, we're going to negotiate on the stimulus, we're going to try to get even more of what we want into it, maybe we'll negotiate on health care, get some stuff like, medical malpractice reform and other Republican health savings accounts and other Republican priorities into Obamacare, and force him to compromise with us. They said no. We're just going to vote no en masse, and that's created that's hurt Republicans substantively, in that Obama has been able to pass a pretty big agenda, I write. That's a lot about what my book's about, with financial reform, with healthcare reform, but particularly with the stimulus, with energy reform and education reform and health IT and research and all that other stuff. At the same time, though, Obama's paid a price too, because right. to pass all that stuff, he's had to hold down every Democratic vote, and that means any Democrat who squawked was able to hold him up for a Cornhusker kickback or a Louisiana purchase with health care. In the stimulus, I tell some kind of funny stories about how, there were a couple of Republicans supported it. So Arlen Specter, who later became a Democrat, he insisted on $10 billion for the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, which somebody who was in the room described it as sort of the most noble shakedown they've ever seen. He just said, no stimulus without without $10 billion for NIH. On the other hand, Susan Collins insisted that she wouldn't vote for the stimulus unless Obama took out a $10 billion program to renovate America's schools and make them more energy efficient. She was involved in some kind of fight with her governor over how school construction money was spent. And so that disappeared. Those were the kind of compromises that he had to make when he had really no chance of getting 40 Republican votes on something like this.
But since the irony is of your book, actually, is that your book is the legislative legacy for the most part of the Obama administration. Since 2010, they've been able to get very little done.
Well, that's true. And in fact, I write about how in 2012. He didn't really have an agenda. He didn't really have a second-term agenda, except don't elect Mitt Romney because he'll reverse,
right.
What we did in the first term. And to the extent he's tried to add an agenda, it's been guns and gun control and immigration reform, which for the same reasons have been blocked by the lack of a Democratic House of Representatives like he had in 2009. That said, he did a lot in 2009. People
True.
Have sort of forgotten it, and if all he can do in his second term is, make Obamacare work and sort of build on his clean energy legacy with some kind of regulation of coal plants and other carbon-emitting sources in the economy, if he can make Race to the Top work and expand on education reform and just kind of keep the economy, if not, you know, which has sort of hit, if not a cruising speed, it's at least sort of at blah speed. It's still growing. If he can kind of keep a decent economy and maybe make some infrastructure improvements that he's talked about, and if he can finally get healthcare reform really going over these next four years, that'll be quite a legacy. You know, he'll have completely transformed the way we drive and the way we work and the way, you know, the way we go to the doctor and the way we send our kids to school. And for better or for worse, that will be a very consequential presidency.
And I think Obama is very cognizant of that because he has studied transformative presidencies. That's why he admires Reagan. Reagan was a transformative president.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and I think he's tried to do similar things. I think that he sees health reform as in some ways the sort of last link in the welfare state, right? The idea that that everybody should have some sort of catastrophic health coverage, and that you know, getting sick should not force you to go bankrupt, to provide a certain amount of economic security there, and that, particularly with climate change, is really the sort of the great challenge facing his generation and, you know, and really the world over the next, you know, couple of decades. I think that this was a, you know, he always phrases it as, you know, the kind of we're in this together approach versus you're on your own. The stimulus was, you know, a very solid investment in this notion that not that government can do everything, but there are things that you need government for, and you're starting to see the fruits of that. You know, whether people like it is something that we'll be arguing about for decades. But the idea that it was, you know, which Republicans have done a really excellent job of making it sound like the stimulus was $800 billion worth of garbage, essentially, you know, kind of, you know,
right,
cocaine
that's
monkeys,
yeah,
and
exactly,
you know, and all kinds of nonsense, when in fact the fraud has been infinitesimal. It's been one of the cleanest government programs in history, and that there really were very, you know, there were some cats and dogs in there, but this idea that it's all honeybee insurance and turtle tunnels and the kind of stuff that sounds funny in a soundbite is really untrue. It's about a half dozen of the world's largest solar farms and America's largest wind farm and America's first cellulosic ethanol refineries and an entirely new battery industry for electric vehicles that was started from scratch thanks to the stimulus, and a new energy agency that's doing some of the kind of cutting edge research into the clean energy of the future, and again the health electronic medical records so that your doctor won't kill you with his chicken scratch handwriting, and the largest investments in the safety net since LBJ. These were pretty big things.
Now, yeah, we only got a few minutes left, and I know your time is limited, but you have a great Rahm quote. That has to be, you know, one thing that you can impart on us that was probably off the wall that Rahm said.
Oh, my favorite Rahm quote? You know, it was probably, you mentioned the middle class tax cuts.
Right.
And there was a funny scene because Obama's economists, and this was a perfect example of how they were actually thinking a lot more about how to get the policy right than the politics right. You know, Rahm's idea was, well, okay, we're going to cut taxes. Let's just send everybody a check and write at the bottom, like, you know, love Barack Obama, so everybody knows to cut their taxes. But instead, the economists had this better idea where instead they were going to dribble it out just a few dollars a week by reducing your withholding, because the behavioral economics says that if you see that you're getting a big windfall, you know, the check comes in the mail, you're more likely to spend it because you're more likely to notice it. You're more likely to save it, and because you're more likely to notice it. And the idea of a stimulus is to try to get people to
spend it.
But of course, you know, then you're less likely to notice it. That's so Rom went on this real tear where, you know, and of course it's all, I can't say this on a family radio show, but basically he said that we're denying ourselves an Ed McMahon moment, right? That kind of publisher's clearinghouse pleasure you get when you tear open the envelope from Barack. I interviewed him like a couple years later, and it was, I'll forget the exact quotes, but I remember asking him about it, and he said something like, well, the economists who had their, you know, had their theories, they were correct about which was the best way to do this, and you know, it was obvious in every pore that he did not think the economists were correct to do this, and as a result, 95% of the country got a tax cut, and less than 10% of the country noticed it.
You know, I think it's funny. Obama went to the Democratic caucus meeting right around the time that the stimulus was being passed, and he apologized. He knows. He said, "I know Rahm has been really hard on you guys, but he's not as bad as you think." And he said, "You know, in fact, the reason why he's not here right now is he's teaching disadvantaged inner city kids how to swear."
Exactly. I mean, that story I told you about Arlen Specter, may he rest in peace. I mean, Rahm had, I mean, that whole page of my book, I think, is not suitable for children. But it was one of those things where Arlen Specter said he wanted $10 billion for the NIH, and Rahm said, no bleeping way. And Specter said, no, that's what I need. And he said, you must be bleeping crazy. And he said, well, that's the way it's going to be. And Rahm says, you know, so you're telling me you need $10 billion and this thing can't be more than $800 billion? How the bleep am I going to give every senator $10 billion and still keep this bleeping thing under $800 billion? His head was about to explode. There are all kinds of stories of him going off on the Blue Dog Democrats, on the Republicans, on just about everybody. But ultimately, you know, he got the bill across the finish line, and
he did it.
And one of the lessons, I think, you know, Rahm was a really good, he was sort of he reflected that Obama idea that, you know, change that doesn't get 60 votes in the Senate doesn't make change. You know, you got to pass the bill through Congress, and if that means you got to stick on $150 million for, Filipino war veterans because the Senate Appropriations Chairman is still upset that they haven't gotten paid for their service in World War II. Look, you know, sending some checks to 90-year-old guys in Manila was not very good stimulus, but that was the price he had to pay to get this thing passed. And ultimately, the larger bill achieved just about every goal that they set out.
And so we only have a few seconds left. So the book is The New Deal, The History of the Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. Michael's website is Michael Grumwald, GRUMWALD.com. And so if people want to follow you on Twitter, how should they do that?
It's at Mike Grunwald, and yeah, I'll be at the Miami Book Fair on the 23rd. I think I'll be on the panel for the Florida Book Awards, which they were nice enough to give me one this year.
Well, no, definitely deserve it. And so definitely pick it up. It's a New York Times bestseller. And it was a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Anytime. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Michael Grunwald. And when we come back next week, we'll do our Thanksgiving episode of Things We're Thankful For on the Internet. And until then, court is adjourned. Have a great week. Be sure to download our web app, our mobile app, and listen to us wherever you are. Thanks again.
This has been a presentation of WebmasterRadio.fm, the world's largest business-to-business radio and podcast network. We welcome you to sample past episodes of this program, as well as our complete library of programs, on demand or on the air via our 24/7 live audio stream at www.webmasterradio.fm. The opinions expressed on this program
are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.